Now hear the case of Alberta Development Partners versus Bugelli.
If it pleases the court, Mike McKinnon, registration number 24689, appearing on behalf of appellant Emmanuel Bugelli. As we've indicated in our briefs, I believe that we can cut to the chase, which is section 4.4 of the contract says specifically that if Alberta did not terminate within 120 days, and it's roughly December 10, 2005, they didn't terminate by about mid-April 2006, unequivocally, clearly, couldn't be any clearer, it says the earnest money becomes non-refundable.
Let's cut to the chase. 4.7 says there's other circumstances in which the earnest money is refundable as well. Why doesn't it qualify under 4.7 as the trial court said it would?
Well, two reasons. Number one is if you remember the order, the court didn't even get far enough to get into the other circumstances. But the reason being is two is 4.7 says, look, you have two things you can do. You can either go ahead and terminate, or, and that's the key, or you can decide you want to go and extend.
Can we consider that argument on appeal?
Well, I think you can, because again, it's a de novo review here, because we are looking at a contract, even though the court of the trial court didn't address it.
And you didn't raise it.
Oh, we did. We raised it in our brief in response to when we raised it. We raised it with the court saying that under 4.7, that's the reason for the return of the earnest money, and then. Basically, we just said overall that the summary judgment should not have been granted, and as a de novo review under the summary judgment and the contract, you can look at both provisions. And I think under our initial brief and our reply brief, it's properly preserved for appeal. That's the first part is.
Mr. McCann, let me just follow up on that. You make the argument specifically with regard to paragraph 4.7 that the. That there was an alternative for ending the contract of either extending the government period or I forget what the other alternative was, but that's the argument that wasn't made in the trial court, as I understand it.
I'll go back as I recall in the issue raised by the motion for summary judgment, in our response, we indicated that, no, look, 4.4 controls, and that was it. The issue of going ahead and actually whether they can terminate or they can extend was not addressed by the court. Yes, it wasn't brought up in our response brief, but again, this is now looking at a contract issue. De novo of the different provisions of this contract, and number one, just seeing in the first place, did the trial court err in granting summary judgment in taking into consideration all of the provision of 4.7 and not just 4.4? I think that's probably before the court, and I think a de novo review allows this court to go ahead and look at all of those issues. And the other thing is what's at this point the answer brief raised it, yes, saying here 4.7 is the controlling section here, so I think we can go ahead and reply and say, no, look, that's the reason it's not controlling is because you had the option terminate or extend, and they chose to go ahead and extend, so then our argument was, guess what, waiver at that point applied. As to one of the crucial things about the trial court was, where I saw the error was, yes, it didn't even consider, didn't even take any time to go ahead and address the 4.4 argument. Never said, hey, by the way, Mr. Bugelli, you're absolutely wrong because the section of 4.4 may say it's non-refundable, but here's why I find it's not non-refundable according to section 4.7. So we kind of start over again here with the arguments in front of this court to say, look, in interpreting this contract, I think we have to go ahead and look, say, what section prevails here. The more specific, clear provision that says it's non-refundable after 120 days. We don't have to get to 4.7, I submit, because at that point it's non-refundable, and 4.7 goes ahead and says that if they go ahead and extend, which they did, didn't make any difference anyway. The
Let me ask you about your 4.4 argument. Your argument is there is a material issue of fact, at least a material issue of fact exists as to whether or not there was a default with respect to the lease of the third party.
Correct.
And you're basing that on essentially your affirmative defense of waiver?
Well, also
what facts or what evidence did you set forth to put an issue as to whether or not Alberta Nguyen consented to your to the continued presence on the property of the third party?
In the brief back to the trial court, there was a couple of issues that we did raise. Number one was the fact that they did consent, and Mr. Bajelli did do an affidavit as attached to the response, saying that they consented, they knew about it. The inference that can be drawn here, and I look at it this way, I say that there was, it was not until August of 2007, so over almost a year in which Alberta knew that the third-party lease was continuing on a month-to-month basis.
How do we know Alberta knew it was continuing?
Because it the inference can be drawn is in a...
What evidence is there from which to draw the inference that Alberta would have known that there was someone still on that property?
And that's the question being is, because Mr. Bajelli's affidavit indicates that he had spoken with Mr. Cutliffe and informed him that Spradley was staying on the property and continuing to on a month-to-month lease.
Is Mr. Bajelli's affidavit that specific about having spoken to Cutliffe and informed him, or is it just say Alberta and Cutliffe knew and consented?
Knew and consented. So I think at that point, that's a factual issue then.
Well, isn't that fairly a conclusory statement, and do conclusory statements present factual issues?
They can, because again, I believe we're entitled to all the inferences that could be drawn from it, and the inference that could be drawn from it is that 10 days before they decide to terminate, they sent out a notice of default saying that you had, you know, that this third party lease going on, yet we're going to go ahead and terminate anyway because we didn't get governmental approvals. So it's clearly a year from when they said the other extensions were in their answer brief, in their reply brief, in their in the trial court, that there was this extension somehow from up to September of 2006, and then it was extended again from August to August of 2007. So that clearly from their briefs, there was knowledge, or she showing that they had some knowledge of what was going on at the time of Mr. Bajelli saying I consented to, or that Mr. Cutliffe consented to it, and he had knowledge of it. That's clearly a factual issue that we would submit needs to go back to the trial court, because what Alberta is asking this court to do is say, look, bypass the trial, bypass whether there was any specific default by Bajelli, fine, because there was a, we terminated the lease, and we found out that we, you know, that there was some type of a third party lease going on. You should go ahead and enter summary judgment for us now, when in fact we have, you know, multiple issues of fact as to the lease with Spradley said that any type of extension or option had to be in writing. There was no evidence of that presented by Sprat or by Alberta. Specifically, it said that there had to be some type of written, that Alberta had to be involved in the process of extending. Well, there was no extension. It was on a month-to-month lease, a month-to-month basis, which at any point could have been terminated.
Well, that's interesting, because they presented a couple of exhibits where Mr. Bajelli seems to characterize whatever's happening as an extension of the lease.
And they characterize that as it, but as
Mr. Bajelli characterized it as an extension of the lease.
And again, that's in Mr. Bajelli's lay terms, but if you look specifically at the Spradley lease, it says that any extension has to be in writing. There's no document whatsoever signed by all the parties saying we've extended the lease. That's one of the key, that's a factual issue that the trial court has to determine. The trial court has to determine also, in the end, what were the conversations or what was the communication between Mr. Bajelli and Mr. Cutliffe, which would have gone ahead and potentially raised the issue of, is there a default by Mr. Bajelli?
Why is that a factual issue? There's no allegation that there were conversations between Mr. Cutliffe and Mr. Bajelli as to the third party staying on the on the property. There's no indication in the affidavits that they had these discussions.
But there is, we have contradicting affidavits by Mr. Bajelli saying that Mr. Cullivan and Alberta were aware of, had knowledge of, and consented. And then Mr. Cullivan, on the other hand, saying, no, I didn't consent to it. So I think there's nothing more. I mean, that's as clear a disputed factual issue as you can get right there, saying, guess what? One party says one thing, one party says the other thing. There's inferences, again, to be drawn that in all this time, 10 days before they decide to terminate because of this, you know, lack of governmental approval, they're also saying, oh, by the way, you're in default. Well, if I were going to take their side and say, we don't care if he's in default because guess what? We get to terminate anyway under Section 4.7 because it says that if we don't get governmental approvals, we get to terminate. So what's the point of setting out a right to cure a default if you get to terminate anyway? And that's what struck me as a little odd as to their argument. So that's why I think at this point, we'd ask the court to just focus on Section 4.4. I don't think there's any clear instance where that is the only applicable section here. And at this point, find that there are there's disputed issues of fact as to the alleged default by Mr. Bajelli and send it back to the trial court so that there can be a trial on these issues. And I'll reserve my last 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Morning, Randolph Dement, registration number 16831 for Alberta Development Partners and Peter Cudlip. As the court knows from reading the briefs, the purchase and sale agreement had various stages for the parties to go through, ultimately leading hopefully to a closing. Both sides stated and knew in the contract that the reason for this proposed purchase was to build a retail shopping center up in Silverthorne. That's the essential purpose of the contract. So we go through a survey period and then a property inspection period, followed by the governmental approvals period, which is a quite extensive up in Silverthorne, as the record reflects. The word non-refundable in Section 4.4 it doesn't support Mr. Bajelli's position, because even he admits in his brief that you cannot pick out a section of a contract and read it in isolation and ignore everything else. The contract clearly states that the earnest money was refundable after expiration of the inspection period in 4.4, because we're then in the governmental approvals period. And Mr. Bajelli acknowledges this in his opening brief. There's three different places I counted, at least, that he acknowledges that. After the inspection period was over, the earnest money could become refundable to the buyer if there was a subsequent breach of the contract by the seller. That language is in Section 4.4 itself and also in Section 7.2. Alternatively, there could be a refund of the earnest money if governmental approvals were not received within the governmental approvals period. And that's, of course, in Section 4.7. Yes, sir.
Right. And opposing counsel says 4.7 doesn't help you out here because the trial court misinterpreted it. The trial court interpreted it to say, well, you can get a refund even after the extended governmental approval period. What in the language of the 4.7 indicates that you could get a refund of the earnest deposit money after the extended governmental approval period?
In Section 4.7, and this is top of page 5 of the agreement, about halfway through, it clearly states Alberta can extend the governmental approvals period, all caps or initial caps for governmental approval period. And that's exactly what it says. And if you extend a governmental approvals period, then by a matter of common sense, you're still within the governmental approvals period.
Thank except the language seems to suggest you have two alternatives. You can terminate after the 200-day period and get your refund, or you can extend and pay some additional deposits. What would be the purpose of saying, well, pay us $20,000 more additional earnest money if in 30 days you're unsuccessful, you get back the $20,000 and the $100,000? What would be that purpose? Why would we even give you the $20,000?
Give Mr. Pagelli some money to have while the time period's extended.
30 days?
Sir?
30 days?
Yes, 30 days at a time.
Mr. DeMint, I want to follow up on Judge Daly's question about the $20,000. Is there any evidence in the record that $20,000 was paid for either of the two 30-day extensions?
It's undisputed that $20,000 was not paid.
Is there any
for either of the two extensions?
Excuse me, is there any explanation in the record as to why it was not paid?
There's not an explanation in the record.
And does the failure to or the absence of information in the record that was paid have any bearing at all on our analysis of 4.7?
No, Your Honor, because assuming the $20,000 was not paid, then you have a contract then that ends at the initial expiration of the governmental approvals period. Because if the $20,000 isn't paid, one could argue that therefore your attempt to extend the period was no good because the money wasn't paid under the contract. I'm just saying that's an argument. If so, then you're under Section 4.7's end or termination of the governmental approvals period, therefore termination of the contract, and under 4.7, refund the earnest money. Now, I don't think this either-or language in Section 4.7 is disjunctive. I think the only disjunctive language in Sections 4.7 is that if the buyer terminates the contract, then it cannot extend the governmental approvals period.
I don't think you need a either or for that. If you terminate, there's no need for a governmental approvals period.
Correct.
And if you look at the structure of 4.7, it goes either X, terminate with refund, or Y, extend. So I think I'm missing your point here.
Well, it says extend the governmental approvals period. So if you're extending the period, you're still within the period.
Well, isn't the period
as extended?
I'm sorry, isn't the period though specifically defined as the 210 days after the earlier period?
The governmental approval period was the 210 days after expiration of the property inspection period.
Right, and so that would be the government approvals period in quotation marks that the contract refers to. And so it's a little bit more of a leap to say that by extending it, you extend what's been defined as the governmental approvals period, rather than going into something else, an extension of the governmental approvals period.
And under that reasoning, then, this period of time where we're extending the governmental approvals period, we have no characterization or no label to say what it is. What I'm arguing is that common sense and plain language reading of the contract, it says extend the governmental approvals period. So if you're extending it, you're stepping into or remaining in the governmental approvals period.
Well,
it remains in effect.
It's a little bit abstract, but I suppose that whether you look at it as stretching out the governmental approvals period or stepping out of it into an extended period, stepping out of it into something else. You see sort of the conceptual difference there?
I don't think so. I think you're just the period becomes the period later.
With additional $20,000 payments supposed to be made for each additional period. Why would that be necessary if basically you can get back the original $100,000 anyway?
Again, to give the seller some money in his pocket or incentive while the contract is continuing. That's my understanding. Although if the seller says, I'll extend the period, but I don't need my $20,000, obviously, in the record, there's no objection by Mr. Bargelli to extending the period without the extra $20,000. There was some arguments by Mr. McKinnon with respect to this alternative summary judgment argument that the trial court did not reach, and that's a breach of the contract by virtue of extending this third-party lease. In the record, as the court's aware, Exhibit 7 to our summary judgment brief is the series of letters between the landlord, Mr. Bargelli, and the tenant, this automobile company, where they're going back and forth about extending or extension of the lease and paying increased rent under the lease. Now, the fact that we attached those papers to our summary judgment brief doesn't mean Alberta knew anything while this extension was going on. There's discovery rules available in the trial court, which we availed ourselves of. You receive documents concerning extension of a lease, and it's material to summary judgment papers, then we attach them. The court is right. There's a bald affidavit, unsupported by Mr. Bargelli, that Alberta knew about this extension. But even if Alberta did supposedly know, there's nothing in writing, because the contract is clear. It says not only does Alberta have to participate in these negotiations to extend the lease, but also we have to give prior written consent. Presumably, if Mr. Bargelli had something in writing from Alberta consenting to this extension, it would be part of the record, and it's not, because it doesn't exist.
Mr. DeMint, Mr. Cudlip said in an affidavit in the trial court that he wasn't aware that the car dealership was still had its lease extended or was still functioning there. How is that possible when a simple view of the property would show that the car dealership was still in operation?
I think he said, if I recall his affidavit, that I think he said he was aware that the auto dealer was occupying the premises, but he did not know that there was an extension of the lease. And that's my recollection of the affidavit, and I apologize, but I do know he wasn't involved, nor Alberta, in this first six-month extension and then another six-month extension, any of that.
Was this property, is there any evidence in the record as to where in Silverthorne this property is located?
Yes.
Is it like out of town in an obscure location?
No, it's described as by address and by general location, Buffalo Mountain Road. It's right near the outlet malls, and I think that's what the record says, at least directionally. You can look.
Mr. DeMint, I found the affidavit from Mr. Cudlip. He said, contrary to the statement in paragraph 6 of Mr. Bargelli's affidavit, Alberta Development Partners and I were not aware, much less fully aware, that Spraddle Creek Auto Sales was remaining on the property as a month-to-month tenant. Does that mean that he wasn't aware that they were on the property, or just that they weren't aware that they were on the property as month-to-month tenants?
I think what he said was as a month-to-month tenant.
So you would read that as an inference that he would admit to knowing that they were on the property?
Yes, I think he actually in his affidavit did acknowledge that he just didn't know what was going on with respect to whether there was a lease still in effect, what was it extended or what. And of course, the question is, why didn't he or Alberta get to participate in that? Lastly, with respect to attorney's fees awarded by the trial court. Mr. Bugelli's trying to have it both ways. I think on the one hand, he's saying there's a contract and the earnest money became non-refundable, even though Mr. Cudlett put up the money for Alberta. But on the other hand, he's saying there's not any damages and no allowance for attorney's fees because Alberta didn't put up the money itself. But what he's doing in this case, and has been from the outset, is seeking to enforce the contract against both Alberta and Cudlett, seeking to retain the earnest money and obtain, receive attorney's fees pursuant to the provisions of the contract. It's an estoppel argument for him to make that claim and then says, well, we can't turn around and make that same claim. I'd also note that all of the parties entered into this trust agreement where they moved the earnest money from the title company into an attorney's trust account. And that trust agreement says, we're all going to go to the district court and let the district court tell us what to do with this money under the purchase and sale agreement. So I think there's somewhat of a hypocritical or conflicting argument on the part of Mr. Bugelli about lack of entitlement to attorney's fees.
Mr. DeMint, I know your time is almost up, but I just want to ask you a quick clarification question. What is the relationship between Alberta and Point Properties? Because the presentation that Mr. Cudlett made before the Silverthorne Town Council lists that he was appearing on behalf of Point Properties.
Right, and I think in the record we said we don't know how that ended up, perhaps with this business card that one business card says Alberta, one says Point Properties, but that's what the record says, the Silverthorne Town Council minutes on behalf of Point Properties.
Well, what is Point Properties related to Alberta, or are they two entirely separate companies?
They're separate entities, separate and distinct entities.
So all of these, this information in the minutes of the Silverthorne Town Council are just erroneous?
That's my understanding, and I think that's what we stated in the trial court.
Okay.
Moreover, I would say that under the town code, whether it's Cudlett, Alberta, Point, or whoever, the applicant, the person that gets the governmental approvals, is the owner of the property, Mr. Bugelli.
Okay.
Technically is the applicant.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd just like to address Mr. Dement's argument regarding the attorney's fees. Is we're not trying to have it both ways. Is unfortunately, we have Mr. Cudlett, who's not a party to the contract, who shouldn't be entitled to attorney's fees, yet the court went ahead and said he's entitled to attorney's fees. We have Alberta, on the other hand, who was a party to the contract, who didn't put up the disputed money, who, in our opinion, is not the prevailing party because they did not get any of the benefit whatsoever of what the litigation was about, which was to go ahead and get the $100,000 back. So our argument is to say the trial court erred in awarding attorney's fees, and that's just because of the situation of how Alberta and Mr. Cudlett brought their claims in this case. So we don't think.
So let me ask you, in this case, if Alberta had just sued and said, give us our money back, you would have responded by saying it's not your money. And if Cudlett would have sued and said, give me my money back, you would have said, you're not entitled to it. You're not under the contract. So how could Cudlett have gotten his money back?
He could have maybe come under some type, could have been a third-party beneficiary type of a claim. I'm not sure if that would be the situation. It could have been he could have gone ahead and very easily brought a claim for the $100,000 itself, and said that Alberta's not entitled to it, I'm entitled to it, and Alberta has no claim to it because Alberta went ahead and terminated. I think he could have said some type of a claim that way. I'm not sure, but the bottom line becomes is, you know, when one party sues for money that supposedly is for the benefit of another party, There may be a third-party contract there, but that's the claim they didn't bring. I think that to allow them to benefit from Alberta entering into the contract and get an award of attorney's fees when Alberta got nothing out of the contract whatsoever, I think is error. And I think that the trial court should not have awarded attorney's fees and made it clear that was the case here. The only thing I'd leave the court with, and I think it understands at least our argument with regard to the third-party leases, a material breach of contract is a question of fact. We've cited that in our brief. We just asked the court to go ahead and look at the case and send it back to the trial court, because I think there is disputed issues of fact with regard to the third-party lease, and I think clearly the court will interpret the contract as it sees fit, but I think that Section 4.4 and 4.7 are completely distinct, and 4.4 is the only provision applicable at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both very much.